Gentlemen, Jean Guccione has been brought to Australia by the Foundation of Economic Education, represented by Ron Manners here. He has been offered to us for a talk today by the leaflet, which I hope you all have read. He is a speaker of genuine world standing, and I think we are very lucky to have him. I'd like you to welcome Jean Guccione.
I'm looking for my notes, and I see here something I can make heads or tails out of. Anyway, I don't have a prepared talk, so don't be frightened by this paper I just got out of my bag. You don't mind if I sit down. I look much better sitting down. But I'll talk about mostly is the state of the Australian mining industry in this enormously lengthy period of about 5 weeks that I've been in Australia. So take what I say with the proper discount rate. And then, of course, I can talk a little more knowledgeably about the condition of the American mining industry. And just to set the thing in perspective, if I were to be asked how does the Australian mining industry compare with the American mining industry, and I've been asked this several times, and this reminds me of the same thing that General Ludendorff wanted to know during World War I. He was in the German High Command, and this was at the tail end of World War I. He wanted to know what the conditions were in Berlin and Vienna. You see, the Viennese people are very much like the Australian people, sort of happy-go-lucky. They like their wine, they like their mistresses, they like their music. Well, anyhow, the message he got... Well, that's your fault. The telegram we got back about the conditions in Berlin was that the situation in Berlin is serious but not desperate. The telegram we got back from Vienna read, "The situation in Vienna is desperate but not serious." That pretty much summarizes what I think of the Australian mining and overall economic situation. The situation is desperate, but Australians, by and large, don't consider it seriously. Excuse me. The common denominator, the source of problems, is the American mining industry, and the Australian mining industry is the same. Government. Now, I have some good news and some bad news about the Australian mining industry. So, what's your good news first? The good news or the bad news?
I think they're all massacres. Give them a...
Give them the bad news last? Okay. All right, the good news first. Australia has an immense mineral wealth, all the way from aluminum to zirconium. From A to Z, as well as all of the fossil fuels. The trouble with underground matter, with rocks, is that none of this potential wealth becomes concretized until you have some man with the knowledge in his brain and the willingness to apply that knowledge to the problem of production to convert that underground chunk into values. And in the process of production, you have what are ultimately very, very ethical questions. Is this right? Is it wrong? Is it true? Is it false? Is it real? Is it unreal? So as you probably know, if not explicitly, at least inferentially, what's involved in the process of production is you're being tested every day. You're honest. Your honesty. Your intellectual integrity. Because not only you have to find the right answer, but you also have to have the integrity to put into effect the answer that you have found and proved to be true, to be correct. So what's involved in the process of production are a lot of conditions. You've got to have something in the ground to work with, and I don't care whether we're talking about minerals or whether we're talking about agriculture. You have to have some concretes. You've got to have knowledge. You've got to have integrity, honesty, willingness to work. And you have to have capital, which mostly comes from the savings of other people, as honest as you are. The problem, so all of this marvelous potential in Australia, whether it's going to be concretized into wealth, depends on whether or not the Australian people are free to create, produce, and exchange values. You can say this about any country, any society at all. Your degree of wealth is concomitant with how free you are to create it. Or as we say in America, if you don't make it, you don't get it. Or if you don't, if unless somebody makes it, nobody gets it. All right, so it is a geologist's dream. That's the first good news. Second good news about Australia, this is in the realm of exploration. Exploration costs, in spite of what you might have heard about inflation, which I'm sure is all true, exploration costs have been going down. I have this from Hrant Kitching, who's one of the most reputable drilling contractors in Australia. Exploration costs have been going down in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, if you wanted to go out in the bush and do exploratory work, you could do it with about $15,000 worth of gear, a couple of jeeps. You would stay out in the bush for about 6 months. You would find a particular ore body, and then you would put it up for sale. Today, you can do what it formerly took you 6 months to do. You can do it in about 2 weeks, and you can do a much better job, but you need about $120,000 worth of gear, worth of analytical equipment. So that when all is said and done, exploration costs have been going down. The third good news about Australian mining has to do with the shaft sinking costs. When you have a deep ore body, one of the principal costs in construction, in putting a mine into operation, is sinking your main shafts, for hauling the ore out of the ground, for bringing your employees, your miners underground, for ventilation. Well, because of better technology and all of the experience that the Australian miners obtained during the mining boom, shaft sinking costs have been going down. So this is all the good news I have about the Australian mining industry. About the bad news, I don't know where to begin first. I have these things written down in the order in which they appear in my notes, in the notes that I gathered as I was traveling to Australia. I haven't written them out in the order of the hierarchical importance, but I think that if I were to put on the basis of first thing first, the biggest problem with Australian mining is inflation, which is the same problem you have at your personal level. Specifically in terms of dollars and cents, in the past 3 years, Australian labor costs have gone up 100%. The average cost per man per shift up to about 3 years ago oscillated between $25 and $30 a day. Today, the average wage per miner is about $50 a day. Plus the fact that Australian workers have the type of fringe benefits that are unheard of in the United States in terms of sick pay, holidays, vacation, workman's compensation, minor sabbaticals. I understand after 10 years or 15 years of work, they can take off, 3 months? Lovely. I've been working for 22 years, and the 1 month that I've spent in Australia has been my vacation. That's an invidious comparison, but bear with me. When it comes to equipment costs, mining costs, and this is part and parcel of the Australian situation, equipment costs have gone up immensely. You can't compare, as you know, the wholesale price increase or the consumer price increase or whatever is the official rate of inflation in Australia with the incremental rate of increase per annum in mining equipment. Those go up at a rate of about 40% per year. Among other things, you have these high protective tariffs in Australia. To protect what? Well, to protect your most inefficient industries. I'm absolutely shocked when I see, for instance, the prices in some of your automobiles. Now, you are MBAs. You appreciate the importance of division of labor, both at the national level and at the international level. I wonder whether it makes any sense for Australians to pay twice for a car when they could get a $3,000 car in America, and after they pay shipping costs, they could buy the same car for $4,000 in Australia, assuming that it costs $1,000 to ship the car. But you got to protect your domestic industry, so you wind up paying something like $8,000 for a $3,000 car. It doesn't make sense. You're dissipating your capital in those industries, and then you protect this malinvestment by all sorts of protective tariffs. So this cuts both ways. It hits you from the point of view of consumers. It hits you from the point of view of producers. Mining equipment costs go up, have been going up at a rate of 40% a year, aggravated by your domestic inflation and your high protective tariffs. Fuel costs. In the past 2 years, I visited a lot of mining camps in Western Australia. 2.5 years ago, diesel fuel was 14 cents a gallon. 2 years ago. You know, you generate electricity and power with diesel fuel, residual oil. Today, it costs you 34 cents a gallon. That's about 150% increase in fuel costs. All right. You can blame the Arabs for part of that increase. But that is an additional problem that you have and that we also have in the States. So, your inflation, an overvalued Australian dollar. I haven't read too much on what caused this overvalued currency of yours. I have the hunch, from having read a number of papers and having talked to a number of people, that what led to the overvalued Australian dollar was that period in the late 60s and early 70s when you had a mining boom here in Australia. A great deal of foreign capital came into Australia, and at the tail end of that mining boom, you had a change, a drastic change in political ideology, if you will, here in Australia. And it is conceivable, knowing how politicians think, or do not think, that they looked at those figures, at this foreign investment capital, and perhaps, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, they misread them as a favorable balance of trade, and they thought, well, this is increasing demand for Australian dollars, therefore, let's peg the price upwards. This will have the immediate political benefit of reducing the cost of all imports, and most of the imports, at least at the consumer level, will benefit the 80% of Australians who live in the major cities, and this is where the big voting blocks are. So revaluing the currency might have been politically appealing at the time, and there might have been a basis, a foundation, a small foundation of truth as to why it might have made economic and monetary sense when the first upward revaluation was done. So at the beginning, you revalue the currency, you upvalue the currency, and what you do is you're stealing from Peter to pay Paul. If you're the government, you're harming all your export industries in order to favor your big voters in the urban areas. Later on, as your own internal inflation matures, and things in your basic industry, wool, agriculture, mining, as conditions begin to get worse, then of course the unemployment from your basic industry spreads out in the upper and upper layers of this inverted pyramid, the apex, the basis of which is mining and agriculture. When that, when those bad conditions spread out throughout the economy, then you know the pressures for devaluing become stronger. At that point, if the government does, if all that the government does is just devalue, then you will have the classical case where devaluation will not solve a damn anything. It will merely give you a couple of months breathing spell, and then it will kick another higher wave of inflation. So there are other things that the government ought to do besides just devaluing in that particular case. If it merely devalues, what it does is it now steals from both Peter and Paul simultaneously, because now all of the urban dwellers have to pay that much more for imports, and all of your exporting industries who in the interim have lost quite a bit of their foreign markets, well, they have to start again earning their share of the foreign market. Okay, within this context of domestic problems, when you look at the problems that have been generated by other countries, by the inflation that was unleashed in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s, and the fact that the ultimate conclusion of any kind of inflation is unemployment, which decreases your aggregate demand, then you have a softening in all sorts of commodity prices abroad, copper, nickel, and all of the major mineral commodities. And if your country is lagging behind is lagging behind the mess of other countries, or perhaps leading the mess, in the case of Australia, you really get the worst of all possible worlds, because you find that your domestic costs are increasing, while at the same time your currency is overvalued, but at the same time you have a falling commodity prices in the world market, the London Metal Exchange. Okay, then to toss off another thing, excessive bureaucracy. This is something that we suffer with in the States, you suffer with in Australia. I understand that for every four miners, there is at least one federal bureaucrat to tell the four miners what to make, how to make it, and when to make it, and whom to hire. Then you have this foreign investment guideline that was introduced by Whitlam in 1973. That requires 50% Australian equity. Well, let's face it, the Australian equity market is very, very thin. If the United States had insisted on 50% equity throughout the 19th century, I doubt that we would have had the burst of productivity throughout the 19th century that we had. Most of our mines, canals, industries were financed with European capital at a time when there were no foreign investment guidelines. Since you are familiar with the what happens with fractional reserve requirement, you know that if your fractional reserve requirements are of the order of 20%, credit expansion is a reciprocal function of that. So this means that one new dollar interjected into the economy is going to expand credit by $5. So just on the basis of that, as long as one investment dollar is not raised locally in Australia to the extent that it is imported into Australia, just by the normal process of credit expansion within the commercial banking system, that would generate $5 of credit. To the extent that that dollar is invested in an industry as basic as mining or agriculture, you're going to get a bigger multiplier than five. Then, if you think you got a liquidity problem, we in America have a liquidity problem. However, if the Australian government had been more oriented to If the Australian government had left producers more free to produce, to create, to exchange values, the climate would have been such that regardless of the liquidity crisis in other countries, capital would have come into Australia. Another item that's bad news about Australia is the opposition to uranium mining for all sorts of issues that have absolutely nothing to do with safety, nothing to do with engineering, nothing to do with technology. In the northwest, in the Northern Territory here in Australia, within the past 4 years, you have discovered as much uranium as it took us in the United States to find in about 35 years. Your known reserves of uranium right now are of the order of about 398,000 tons of uranium oxide. In the States, our known uranium reserves are 400,000 tons. We have been at it for about 35 years. You have been at it for only 4 years. You have barely scratched the surface. I have been told by a number of reputable Australian geologists that wealth of uranium in terms of BTU, in terms of power, in terms of energy, is equivalent to several times the Persian Gulf. And many of those uranium deposits that have been proved, you Australians could have gone into production as early as 3 years ago, or even as late as today, but you haven't, and I know some of the reasons for it. We have the same situation in the United States, where we have about 600 years of coal reserves in the western states that we cannot get to. Our government, just like your government, wants to fine-tune and regulate things to the point that in the United States today, with about 600 years of coal reserves and with an energy crisis that has assumed monumental proportions, you know, in 73, we were importing 37% of our energy needs. This year, as of April, we were importing more than half of our energy needs. We can supply our own energy needs. We have enough coal. Well, anyway, government, you might know our own government, forbids us to burn the high sulfur coal, which we are permitted to mine in the east, while at the same time it permits us to burn the low sulfur coal that we are forbidden to mine in the west. What we can mine, we cannot burn, and what we can burn, we cannot mine. That's the situation that we have. Okay, another bad news. You have labor unions. Now, when it comes to your labor unions, I find nothing wrong with a labor leader who wants more money, more benefits, more vacations, better pensions for his workers. This is what I want, this is what you want. The trouble is when these union leaders penetrate the political structure and they become statesmen and they start telling you what you ought to produce, where you ought to produce, how many people you should hire, how many men should be in charge of a particular drag line or shovel, in what kind of bottoms you are going to ship your commodity abroad, that sort of thing. Then you have the environmentalists, and then you have the worst problem of it all when it comes to miners is the lack of security of tenure. At the moment of the lease, all of the mining conditions, royalties, expiration of the lease, environmental control regulations, taxes, export rates, shipping, railroad freight, all of those things should be spelled out, and there should be a mechanism whereby when the government breaks its own word, the government should be brought to court. But how do you sue the government? I don't know what the answer to that is. Well, I think I've rambled enough here at random to generate some questions from you. In fact, I would like to ask you some questions later on. Jean, sir?
You'll do the interview from my office instead of picking up what's in
there. From your office? Okay, fine. All right. Sir.
Eugene, if I may, you talked about our overvalued currency. There are two problems here. One, the currency is overvalued in terms of what is purchased, probably in terms of our manufacturing cost structure, various factors like that. The other problem is a problem of the balance of payments. In terms of our balance of payments, the currency is probably not overvalued. In other words, I'm saying that our export revenue is probably more than sufficient, and we have reserves per head which are probably higher than any other country in the world in the current time. That's likely to go into our balance of payment on current accounts, likely to go into credit again very shortly because of the export revenue situation, barring a disaster on the agricultural front. How do you resolve that problem?
Well, you know, this is news to me that your export revenues are higher than usual. This is not what I've been told by...
Well, they're not higher than usual, but they're about to go into the credit side, so we'll have a balance of payment surplus on current account in the near future, I would have thought, because you're looking at higher commodity prices, both on the agricultural front and on the mineral front. And the big revenue-earning items, such as iron ore and coal, you're both looking at price increases and very large commodity increases over the next.
You mean in the foreign markets? Or
yeah, in the foreign markets.
Yeah. Okay, well, then you're in good shape. You're in much better shape than I was like to be. I'm learning something. Thank you.
Well, this problem still exists, though. And I guess it's a problem that it's not necessarily in my potential commitment. Our cost structure is high, and our currency is possibly overvalued, but in balance of payments terms. In the short term, it would appear that you know, perhaps the balance is right now, currency value is okay. Yeah. But it's a long term question of resource allocation.
You're talking about balance of payments, right?
Yeah.
What is the this is one thing that is always puzzled me. What is the relationship between your, a nation's balance of trade and the balance of payments? I really don't know. Is it one and the same thing, or are those two separate things?
Oh,
they're
two separate things.
They are two separate things. Well, I think I know what the balance of trade is. What is the definition of balance of payments?
Oh, I can't quite.
What do you include in? I mean, what do you include in it?
The balance of payments, leveraging.
Right. And the balance of trade is only something.
Exports and imports.
Exports and imports. All right. So, what's the Australian balance of trade? Is that the one that is favourable?
It's a net deficit at the moment, but it's quite small. And given further increases in commodity prices or volume, it's likely to get positive.
Well, in the long run, that averages out.
Sorry, that's the balance of payments. Balance of trade is already well in surplus wanes.
Uh-huh.
Invisible to lose out on, but if capital inflow picks up and we get that other factor, we'll be going way into surplus. And our reserves are already higher than probably any other country, with the few exceptions of Arab Emirates and this sort of thing, than any other country in the world.
What are some of the most profitable things that Australia exports to have this increase in this trade surplus?
Well, I think it must be our agricultural and mineral products.
Yeah, but that's not the story that I hear from mining companies and cattle ranchers and wool growers and your agricultural people.
Isn't it a fact too that
they keep telling me that they're not making any money?
Yeah, they're not.
So somebody must be making some money somewhere.
They might not be making any money, but there's still a large volume going overseas, generating a very large positive cash flow in this country. You get a good balance of payments, you still make a loss in terms of it.
You know, when it comes to balance of trade, I remember something that Jacques Rouef told me about 4 years ago. He was talking about this business of balance of trade, surplus, and the trade figures and so on, and he said every country in the world wants to have a surplus in its trade figures. That's obviously an impossibility. And then he told me this little story about the French wine merchant who, let's say, bought $100,000 worth of French wine, and he brought them to England, and as he was crossing the river, the jerk at the frontier in France put down exports $100,000. Well, when the French merchant went to London and he sold his wine, he sold it at a profit, let's say $150,000 profit, to the extent that he was a good businessman, he knew that there was a requirement for British woolens in Paris. So he invested $150,000 in British woolens. And when he crossed the border again, the same jerk at the border wrote down imports from England, $200,000, ergo trade deficit $100,000. And Rueff's conclusion was, had this wine merchant met a storm crossing the strait and everything had gone down to the bottom of the sea, there would have been a perennial surplus of $100,000 in favor of France. And he also did a study of the industrialized nations of Europe from 1870, from the time that Germany and France had their own internal bickering, to about 1922, when there was the Genoa International Monetary Conference, and he came out with what I thought were astounding figures, that the more industrialized the nation is, the more it's going to tend to lose in the so-called trade figures. There may be a great many instances where a negative trade balance, where an apparent loss, is actually in effect an index of how profitable your own businessmen are. I toss this to you for what it's worth. I understand by talking to mining people, they're being driven up the wall with increasing costs. They cannot compete. This is what they tell me, and I have no reason to disbelieve that. They tell me that they cannot compete even with American copper companies. And we don't have anywhere like the kind of wealthy, rich ore bodies that you have. We are lucky if we can find a 0.3% copper ore body. Here in Australia, you find 3.5-4% copper ores that we haven't been able to find for the past half a century.
Yeah, but they're two different questions. You're saying you've got lower costs and you've got mines and lower grades and so on. We've got high-grade mines and high profits potentially, but their costs are higher. But that's a different problem with the balance of payments and the value of their currency.
Mm-hmm. What I like to know, who is making the money in Australia today? I'm enjoying this conversation because I'm learning something that I didn't know before.
I still feel that we're talking at a particular point in time now. Australia has, in the last few years, achieved significant pluses with its export earnings from resources, both agricultural and mining. But where, if something doesn't change damn quickly, Australia's going to be so far up the wall in a very short space of time. And I'm not talking 20 years, I'm talking 5 years. For example, in 5 years' time, our net import bill for oil alone, forgetting any other damn thing, will be over $2 billion. So just to maintain our current status quo, we have to significantly improve the levels and values of our export earnings in other commodities, if we're talking mineral commodities, and that, given the Australian cost structure at the moment, is not very likely.
Just think of uranium.
Yes, come on. No.
Oh, well, that's assuming uranium gets off the ground.
Uranium's down.
That's in 3 years' time. If the go-go was given today, it will be 3 years' time minimum before we start seeing that. And meanwhile, we'll have perhaps several billion dollars to catch up on anyway. It's not that simple, John.
You did it with coal. Same thing with coal.
Yeah, well, coal will be going as well, and then there'll be new areas growing all around.
That's providing you're allowed to export.
I think that probably.
Oh, you tell that to Rex, baby, and
yeah,
Paul
Rex,
Keating now,
Rex
when he gets it when they...
Keating says, one area that the iron ore industry in particular tells us they have a problem in Australia is in dealing with the Japanese steel mills, where all the Japanese individual buyers join together as one to negotiate with several Australian producers. An argument has often been put up that it would be in the Australian interests if all the Australian producers got together and rather than enter into a price cutting or difficulty, if they went to the Japanese as one group of iron ore producers to deal with one group of iron ore buyers. Would you like to comment on whether you'd like to see all the Australian, particularly the West Coast, West Australian producers get together and go to the Japanese as one rather than go as individual companies to negotiate new contracts?
Well, it's obvious that if they go as individual companies, as individual entities, the Japanese, being as smart as they are, they are going to play one iron producer against another, and the church is just good business practice. You try to buy, if you're the buyer, you try to buy at the lowest possible price. You don't want to extol the virtues of the commodity that you want to buy, that you want to get. So you try to play one producer against the other. And that's the trouble that comes in when you have managed economies, like the Japanese economy, versus mismanaged economies, like yours and mine. In the United States, for example, if you were talking to an official of the U.S. government who still entertains, at least on one side of the mouth, the myth that we have free enterprise, he would officially be against that, provided that officially the U.S. government were to organize some sort of the American equivalent of a zaibatsu so that they could deal with the Japanese. Now, that goes counter the American grain, because immediately they see a conspiracy or a monopoly. I don't know how it is here in Australia. I think that an American official would say, no, because we believe in free enterprise. Well, we believe in free enterprise up to a point, beyond a certain point, if the U.S. government could organize, if it were in the shoes of the Australian government, if they could organize a pool of Australian producers, then certainly they would be in a position to command better terms from the Japanese. But then again, you see, you have to get your government involved in trade negotiations. As that very famous British philosopher, formerly a Beatle, man said, whatever the government touches turns to shit. I would think that it would be in the interest of the Australian iron ore producers to try to break this seemingly monolithic block of Japanese buyers, to try to play one Japanese buyer against the other. And if you ask me what kind of system the Japanese have, what do they call it? Do they call it free enterprise? Do they call it some form of benevolent fascism? I haven't got the faintest idea. That has always been a big puzzle to me. What kind of a system do the Japanese have? I don't know. Yeah, when you try to trade with somebody, I mean, you can have all of the good intentions in the world, but you also have to take into consideration how they think and how they design the rules of the game that they're trying to impose on you. And then see if you can get away with breaking their rules of the game and establish the fight so that you are able to compete and to trade and to produce within your own rules.
Gene, can I ask a simple question? You know the old decision-making process, you don't look in the past, you look into the future. You've made mistakes in the past, you look into the future now. You mentioned very often the Australian currency is overvalued. You also know that we have a fair level more than fair of inflation. We still got reserves. I don't know whether it's true, we have highest reserves per capita in the world, but it matters. Now, we are at this point of time, high inflation, overvalued currency, as you say, you know the two conflict. We devalue, we fuel inflation. What would you suggest we should
do? If that's the only thing that you do to fight inflation, if devaluation is the only weapon.
No, it's not the only one, but it's common knowledge that if you do devalue, you help to fuel inflation.
That's right. If that's the only thing you do, like Great Britain, they went into devaluation a couple of times. Right. It seems to me that's the only thing they did. Well, you can't have it both ways. Then in that case, inflation. Devaluation will lead you to an inflationary explosion within the next couple of months.
Right, so what do you do in this situation?
I think that all inflations throughout history have a common symptom, which is high prices. Now, you know, when it comes to a price, that's nothing but a ratio. So many dollars per unit of goods and services. And I think you MBAs know that
at least the way you define the general price level, you define it as a time function, hence, you know, the term velocity of money, as a time function of the sum of your total available money supply over the available supply of goods and services. There is nothing that you or all of the MBAs from Australia, Sydney, or Harvard put together, you cannot convince the government to stop monkeying around with the rate of increase of the money supply. The Chicago School says, well, we ought to keep the rate of increase of the money supply constant. Well, you can argue until you're blue in the face. If your government is going to run a deficit budget, that budget has got to be monetized. And the worse the budget is, the more is the temptation for the Treasury to sell government instruments directly to the Federal Reserve System or to the Federal Bank, which then has no other alternative but to, quote-unquote, buy the damn pieces of paper and therefore inflate the money supply. But let's assume for a minute that your government would limit itself to what it does best, which is ripping people off, taxation and inflation, hitting them both, but that it would place no obstacles to the creation, production, and exchange of values, then in that case, even a halfway crooked government, by increasing the numerator, if you have your hands free to create, produce, and exchange values, you could also increase that denominator so that the general price level would move sideways instead of going up or going down. In other words, you would have a stabilization in the general price level. What happens is that all governments today cannot resist the temptation of interjecting themselves also in the workings of the denominator under the disguise of, well, the public interest demands that we ought to have an environmental impact statement whenever we launch a new project. Now, I don't know how the devil lawyers in Washington were able to let that kind of a philosophical fallacy, and talking about philosophical fallacies, that is a collector's item insofar as you, as an industry man, you're always put in a position of having to prove a negative. Prove to me that you didn't kill my mother. But Gina, I don't even know who the hell your mother is. How could I kill her? Well, then prove to me that you didn't hire an assassin to kill my mother. Well, you say to me, that's absurd. I don't go around hiring killers. And then I say, well, prove to me that you don't. Well, this is precisely what industry, at least in the United States, has had to cope with the environmental impact statement. You guys are beginning to feel the influence of the environmental impact statement. Let me tell you this one thing. In the United States, we didn't have an environmental impact statement idiocy until 1969, when that great petroleum expert, with the help of that great nuclear expert, I'm talking about Senator Scoop Jackson and Ralph Nader, were able to mobilize Congress into passing the National Environmental Policy Act in 1969. There was a clause in that act that was Process 102, known as the Environmental Impact Clause. You see, prior to the passage of that NEPA bill, that's the acronym, no environmentalist, no ecologist, could bring suit in federal court and stop a federal agency from issuing a permit for, let's say, a pipeline construction, or from issuing a permit for highway use, or from issuing a permit for refinery construction. The moment that that bill was rushed through Congress, anybody at all, even an Arab agent, even a Russian agent, by merely posting a $100 bond, could bring suit in federal court and stop a federal agency from issuing a permit for anything, you name it, under the sun. And this is how Washington created the machinery that has immensely delayed all of the projects. Do you know that for 4 years, not a single petroleum refinery was built in the United States from 1969 until 1973? 1969 was the worst year as far as the American economy was concerned. 1971 wasn't that good either. That was the day when Nixon slapped down the window on August 15th and imposed wage and price controls he was like a miniature Hitler. And how did they, quote-unquote, to use one of your words, how did they denigrate Nixon? On the basis of Watergate. My God, they should, he should have been purged. He should have been, I forget what the legal word for it is. Come to my rescue, please. English is my third language.
Impeached.
He should have been impeached for the imposition of wage and price controls, as well as for the total havoc that he brought to the American economy. At the same time, within the next couple of months, we had to cope with the so-called Mine Health and Safety Act, which generated OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which has generated thousands upon thousands of rules and regulations that are absolutely, totally arbitrary, that were never conceived in the original legislation, and that within a short time shut down a lot of the mines, coal mines in the United States, and that, I'm running out of time. But anyhow, to make a long story short, all of these obstacles to the creation, production, and exchange of values, that is, the total supply of goods and services, that is going to shrink your denominator, while at the same time, you know, deficit budgets, the good intentions of this senator, that congressman, that governor, puts unbearable pressures on the Treasury to raise cash, which then has to be raised. You spend a lot of money, you have to monetize the debt. So your numerator, the money supply, increases. And we got to the point in the United States in 1974 where the increase in the general price level was going up at a faster rate than the increase in the money supply, however you define it, whether it is M1, M2, M3, or MX. So when that particular condition prevails, you can say that your inflation is out of control. Now, we were able to bring our inflation down from 14% in 74 to less than 7% today. We did this by stopping the worst spending bills that Congress put. Gerry Ford was able to stop them. And by Arthur Burns refusing to buy as many government instruments as the Treasury would have liked him to buy. Now, since Arthur Burns at the Fed and William Simon at the Treasury work in unison, not all the time, but most of the time, they walk in the same rhythm. And the fact that Ford was advised by his economic advisors, which were the worst bills that would have created the greatest damage to the economy, and though many of those vetoes were sustained, this is how we were able to cut in half our rate of inflation. And Gerry Ford is the type of man who, according to American columnists, is incapable of chewing gum and walking at the same time. Malcolm Fraser is much smarter than Gerry Ford, so I suppose he will have a better record than Gerry Ford did. That's devoutly to be wished for your sake.
Can we get a comment on your expectations on commodity prices and possibly oil? What you're expecting for the next year or two?
Well, in oil, the situation that is pretty much predicated by the whims of the Arab governments. Even though Iran is not an Arab nation, it is nevertheless a party of the OPEC cartel, isn't it? Now, the Shah is running a deficit. And this is where that's the fate of all of these monopolies, of all of these coercive monopolies. Eventually, one of the partners is going to act against the others because they all have ultimately different purposes, different ideas in mind. He's running a deficit. He has had to borrow money in the European money markets. So the Shah cannot afford to close down the faucet. He wants to open the faucet as much as possible, especially since he's stuck his neck out with all sorts of pressures. Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, doesn't have the kind of pressures of its own people that Iran has, so they can afford to throttle down their oil supply. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia is very much anti-communist. So they think that their fate is more closed to the Western nations. So they're not going to act up. What you're going to see will be, I would think, on the basis of what I know, I'm cutting it down to as few words as possible, will be a minor increase in the price of crude oil on the world level. But, you know, in the United States, we still have to this date control prices for natural gas. A natural producer in the United States is limited to about 50 cents per thousand cubic feet in interstate commerce. If a utility is short of natural gas and has to use natural gas because it hasn't had time to modify its equipment and switch to coal or something else, then they have to buy natural gas from Libya or Algeria or Russia, and there the cost varies anywhere from $1.50 to $2 per thousand cubic feet. So then we have a two-tier level for old oil and new oil. For old oil, the price is $5.25 a barrel. For new oil, for newly found oil, there is an upper limit on $7.25 a barrel. Meanwhile, you know, in the world market, the price of oil is what, $11 a barrel, something like that? In Australia, the situation is even worse. I understand that on gas and oil in the southern part of Australia, you got pretty much at this crazy two-tier level. Old oil is limited to about $4 a barrel. New oil, well, you can get it for about, what is it, $6 a barrel?
$3
Oh, and then there is a $2 levy. So, talk about obstacles to creation of to the creation, production, and exchange of values. That's your denominator. The price mechanism, you see, is the most democratic way by which the population of a country has of making their decisions felt at the national level. Your price mechanism represents the aggregate of the decision of all 14 million Australians who vote every day with their dollar. You know, this is the old laissez-faire argument. And I think it is valid. I think it makes sense. Because when you get into a contractual agreement, nobody is twisting your arm behind your back saying you've got to sign on the bottom line. If you realize that there is no profit in you in that particular exchange, you just don't enter in it. So when 14 million people, by their non-coerced judgment, whether it is right or wrong, it doesn't matter, because in the long run, reality, the market itself, will show you what is the good way in which you ought to, where you ought to invest your money. So if the price mechanism were not interfered with, then this, the price mechanism, would tell people what, where are the unmet needs in the economy, who ought to produce what, when, where, how much, and so forth.
One of the major contributors to our inflation rate late has been a cost push brought about by a very strong union action. What's your answer to controlling the demands of labour increases, cost increases through union action?
This is something I mean, if I were, and I'm not, but certainly if I were a government official or a industry spokesman, respected and who has the confidence of labor union, I would try to convince them of the fact that while I have nothing against a labor leader asking for more and more better terms, looking out for the welfare of his own members, I certainly would resent a union leader trying to dictate national policy and international trade policy. Stay away from those things. And then bring home the fact that if your denominator doesn't increase, you know, in the general price level, unless your productivity increases, that everybody's working overtime to reduce productivity by feather bedding, by all sorts of obstructions to trade and production, so which the unions are mostly blamed for, then you are going to have precisely the kind of situation that has been aggravating in recent years in Australia. More money chasing fewer and fewer goods, and bring home the fact that, for heaven's sakes, sooner or later, double-digit inflation leads to double-digit unemployment. There is no way out of it. A lot of economists look at a depression as an a priori fact that somehow it exists. Well, how did it come about? The history of every inflation is ultimately a depression. Now, who causes inflation? Ultimately, those authorities who have the monopoly over the issue of the currency. And when it comes to the issue of the currency, neither you or I, nor our parents, nor our grandparents ever had a goddamn thing to say about the money supply, about the kind of commodity that we would use either to measure internally the worth of a currency or about its absolute volume. So if you could bring home the point to labor unions that double-digit inflation ultimately means double-digit unemployment, and you can marshal all sorts of arguments, all you have to do is look back in the history of this century alone, never mind, you know, the rest of history, then you could perhaps convey some sense to labor unions. But that, you see, wouldn't be a problem. If labor unions were not featherbed, if they didn't insist on disastrous policies nationally as well as at the international level, we could live, I'm sure that we could live with higher cost push pressures than we do at present. But we cannot live when, along with the cost push, we also have all sorts of artificial impediments that limit our freedom of movement.
Before lunch we discussed that you know Friedman and you agree with 95% of what he said. I just use your figures of 5% not. One of the things he says that labor cost increases cannot cause inflation. Whether that's a 5% you disagree with him,
yeah.
Because labor cost is a commodity like anything else, material cost, anything at all. If it's too expensive, you will not buy it anymore and you will restrict it,
yes.
And therefore not increase inflation. That's just as a comment to what
my
you
friend,
said.
I was victimized by that Milton Friedman idea until about March of this year when I heard in New York City Sylvester Petra, who's director of some institute on labor analysis. He has a magnificent article in the July issue of the Freeman, which is published by the Foundation for Economic Education.
Brilliant.
I would suggest you read that,
okay.
Because up to that time I thought, as Friedman says, that other things being equal, but you know what the hell that means, things are seldom equal, labor is not responsible for inflation. But the thing is, you see that your Reserve Bank, my Federal Reserve System, the Treasury, the government and such, they create the engine of inflation. And what Petra says, who is the driver of that engine? Sometimes the driver happens to be big industry, to the extent that it seeks protection for itself whenever it gets big and flabby. Other times, more often than not, it happens to be unions, labor. So that's what you have to look at.
But the other things in the market, just
Edwin,
we have to go.
This stage closed. I'd like to join with your thanking, Mr. Chief Attorney.